Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
Hello and welcome to the Transfer Window, the podcast that brings you the news before it becomes news, as well as insight and analysis into everything that you're talking about in football. I mean, McGarren with me as always is the doyen of transfers, Duncan Castles. And on this particular podcast, we have news on Manchester City and Pep Guardiola, as well as transfer targets for this summer. Manchester United have been causing a little bit of a fracas with regards to their criticism of referees and the giving of penalties, as well as news on potential Arsenal signings, heroes and villains, and much more. Duncan, we're going to start with Manchester City, and it's our understanding that Pep Guardiola, who has a break clause in his contract, which means he could leave in this summer window, has been promised by City's administrators a transfer budget which would allow him to effectively reconstruct parts of the team that quite clearly need to be attended to, one being, of course, the continuing travails of Sergio Aguero and the fact that they have been playing without a number nine and playing a false nine instead, as well as potential recruitment in defence and even possibly in midfield as well. Would you say, Duncan, that Erling Haaland, who, as you reported on last week's pod, as being available to buy from Borussia Dortmund, would be a suitable and or likely target for Manchester City?
One of the priorities is to recruit a striker, as you say, because of the situation they have with Aguero, running out of contract, not being available for many games this season. If you're going to go into that area to replace the most successful striker in the club's history, you need a very talented player. And there is not a great deal of availability at the top end of the transfer market for strikers in the coming summer. Therefore, it's a complicated choice to make. As you've said in previous podcasts, they haven't done well in these choices in the past. Gabriel Jesus was supposed to be the player who would develop into an Aguero successor, and he hasn't achieved that to the extent that in the summer window before last, City were prepared to trade Jesus to Borussia Dortmund in order to get cash to hire a different striker, and Jean-Felix was one player they'd identified to come into that role. But they've accepted that Jesus is probably not the long-term answer and need to recruit at that end of the field. And they need someone who is capable of playing at the level that they're at, which is defend the Premier League title. That'll be the expectation for next season, given the huge lead they've developed at the top of the table and this 20-match consecutive winning run that they're on at present, and to win the Champions League, which of course is a target this season, but is the fundamental aim of Abu Dhabi, to become the first owners of the club who can get Manchester City to Champions League title. So you need a player of that level. Now, when we discussed Haaland's availability and Dortmund's readiness to sell the player, in a recent podcast, we talked about how Dortmund had come to the conclusion that although he was scoring at an incredible level, the team actually wasn't playing better and the team's results had gone into decline because he was such an individualistic player. Now, can you fit that into the Manchester City system? That's the question mark that I think Manchester City are placing on that prospective purchase at present. Can you develop him in a way that he will fit into Guardiola's kind of style of play? Is he going to become tactically astute enough and generous enough in the way he plays that he will not be a hindrance to the team but will improve their capability of winning the Champions League and keep them in that position of strength in the Premier League? I think the consideration of him as an option is because of the limited availability of strikers in the market and that knowledge that Dortmund are ready to sell the player. And also that the player has no long-term ambition to stay at Dortmund. He has the release clause, not for the coming summer, but the summer going forward. The decision to go to Dortmund was one of career development. He will move at a certain point. So if you ask me, and I think if you ask, more importantly, people who assess the transfer market, whose job is to pick players to fit given systems, Haaland is not that perfect fit. So that, although he's an option for them, they will have to take a risk if they go down that line rather than move for a different striker. As you say, the striker's not the only area that Guardiola wants them to strengthen in. He wants defensive reinforcements again. I'm told a left back is a priority. And wants reinforcements in midfield. And there you have Fernandinho going out of contract and a player capable of filling in for him and strengthening what are really already impressive midfield resources is on their agenda for the summer window.
It's interesting as well, though, Duncan, that City themselves see strengthening the squad as being central to retaining Guardiola for at least another season until his contract currently ends. The fact that they will make funds available. And of course, it's not like they haven't spent a lot of money under Pep Guardiola, but they have been quite thrifty compared to the likes of Chelsea and Manchester United in the last two windows. But they seem to be willing, if you like, to basically incentivize Guardiola to stay. Or I think probably on the basis that other coaches and elite coaches in particular are not available or certainly not on the horizon that they could replace him with. And so it would be in their interests, obviously, to effectively offer him an open checkbook and what he wants with regards to rebuilding and taking the squad forward.
Look, they've never had any real hesitation about spending. As we all know, this is the most expensive squad in the history of football. They've spent more on transfer fee commitments than any club ever. What you have in this summer window is an opportunity because the market is so damaged by COVID, because so many clubs are having to work on restricted budgets, maybe look at one significant signing, but not on the scale of deals that we've seen for several years pre-pandemic. A club like Manchester City, whose limitations on spending are purely financial fair play, something that they've transgressed on multiple occasions, but it managed to escape Champions League bans on all of those occasions, can spend. The Abu Dhabi have the resources to push into the club and to take advantage of the weaknesses of other teams. So it makes sense to go for it again this summer. And now that Guardiola is in a happy place again, now that he is putting together that run of victories and receiving the praise for the way they play, it's an opportunity to have a consistent structure at the club at a time where there was a question mark over how long they could keep Guardiola there for. And if they had got themselves into a position where they had to replace Guardiola, you have that whole difficulty of finding a compatible coach, someone who fits into the system that's been created around him. No club has invested as much and transformed themselves so much to suit the identity of one coach. That transition to a new coach is going to be a difficult one. We'll see what happens this season, but they still haven't won the Champions League. So take advantage of the opportunity where you have a market where you can buy players, where a lot of your opponents can't buy players, and you have that coach in place for another season and another attempt to win the Champions League. And you know, it's quite amusing, I think, Guardiola ahead of their first leg Champions League tie, talking about Manchester City being the best English team in the Champions League over the seven seasons. It's quite a definition stretch to say that they're the best because they were there in every season and got through the group stages in every season, when what you actually see is a pattern of failure and elimination at the hands of clubs with far inferior resources, with tactical errors, game decision-making errors from the coach in those particular matches.
Sounds like the old Arsene Wenger. Should we get a trophy for being top four every season? Another dull and dour draw between Chelsea and Manchester United last weekend, Duncan. Drew a lot of criticism with regards to the way both teams played, to be fair, not just one. The other, of course, contentious issue was the penalty, which was not awarded to United. That prompted a very bizarre exchange in terms of interviews with both Luke Shaw and with Ole Gunnar Solskjaer post-match, in terms of the responsibility that they put on the referee, but more insanely, on a Chelsea website piece, which you pointed out, under 22 paragraphs, had made the point that Manchester United penalty awards had been quite fulsome in the past two seasons. Are we getting to the point now where Solskjaer / United are going into a kind of bunker mode with regards to decision making, as well as the fact that it's a defence, if you can defend it, of the fact that they have not beaten anyone in the top six under Solskjaer this season?
In the league, yes. Look, a lot of controversy over the penalty, a lot of controversy over what Luke Shaw said in the post-match interview, claiming that the referee had told Harry Maguire that he couldn't give the penalty because it would be too much controversy over the decision to give that penalty against Callum Hudson-Odoi. Solskjaer then going into an interview and supporting what Luke Shaw had said, and then raising this subject of outside influences and criticising the Chelsea website pre-match briefing, which is so obscure that the individual interviewing him at the time had to ask him what he was referring to, with his claim that it was influencing the referees. I think a lot of that has deflected from the more fundamental point that Solskjaer's team played in a very predictable fashion, in a fashion that they've played in against big six opponents in almost every match this season, that they failed to score again in those games. So they've now played seven games against what is traditionally called the Big Six in the Premier League this season, lost 6-1 to Tottenham, drawn 0-0 with Chelsea, lost 1-0 to Arsenal, drew 0-0 with Man City, 0-0 with Liverpool, 0-0 with Arsenal, 0-0 with Chelsea, scored just one goal, that from a penalty in that 6-1 defeat in the second minute. So they're now on 628 normal time minutes. We're not including the added time minutes here without scoring against their opponents. We discussed this in the podcast going into the game, whether Solskjaer would actually play that Manchester United way that he talks about and pushes so hard, and especially given the success and the statement that he felt they had made by beating Liverpool in the FA Cup 3-2 by playing an attacking game. And we predicted that they wouldn't, and they didn't. And I think you only have to look at people like Paul Scholes, obviously no enemy of Solskjaer's, reaction to that performance, and him saying post-match and Premier League television, I just don't think they showed enough ambition to win the game. That's been the theme of big games. Do Manchester United go to these places and try and win? Don't look like it. And he made a point, which I think is a correct one, that you can understand why Solskjaer sets up this way against a team like Manchester City in the form they're in, that probably is United's best chance of getting a result against City, is to sit deep, not expose Harry Maguire to the pace that City have in attack, and hope to score a counter-attacking goal using the pace he has in attack and the ability of Bruno Fernandes to put players in on goal. But as he pointed out, they were playing Chelsea, and Chelsea, although unbeaten under Thomas Tuchel, are not an expansive team. They haven't been scoring a lot of goals. They're not quick at the back, and they're not in the team that they played on Sunday, are not quick at front. So in Scholes' view, it was an opportunity to go and win the game, to take Chelsea on and make a statement of the type that Solskjaer had been talking about after the Liverpool game. He didn't do it. And pragmatically, it's probably not a surprise that he didn't do it, because if you look at it from the perspective of the table and you look at it from the perspective of what Solskjaer's employers want, that draw with Chelsea retained the 6-point gap over a team that you would probably say are more likely to qualify for a Champions League place than West Ham, who are in fourth at the moment, might be capable of overhauling Leicester City. And with Leicester City losing at the weekend, it left Manchester United in a more secure position for Champions League qualification. That's the goal of the Glazers. That's the thing that loses you your job at Manchester United, is to fail to qualify for the Champions League and cost the Glazers money. If you look at what Solskjaer said at the start of the season, his target for the season was to be at the top of the chasing pack, as he put it. The pack chasing Manchester City and Liverpool. Well, he's beyond the top of the chasing pack at present, because he's second, albeit 12 points behind Manchester City, but he's got a 7-point gap on Liverpool at present. So from his employer's perspective, from his own targets for the season, this is a success. What we do know is when he did try and play expansive football, first game of the season against Tottenham, the team was destroyed. And every game against the Big Six in the Premier League he's played since, he has gone for the same setup of caution, basically a defensive setup, and hope to nick a goal on the counter-attack and win that way. He was clearly upset that Manchester United are not getting penalties in the way that they have been getting through almost his entire time at the club. He's clearly upset that individuals like Frank Lampard, who he mentioned in his post-match interview, and Jurgen Klopp had highlighted the gross ratio of penalties that Manchester United have received compared to every other club in the Big Five leagues. They're miles ahead of every other club in the Big Five leagues in terms of penalties
35
awarded.
35 penalties in the last 18 months.
Yeah, look, you can break the statistic down in various ways, but between August 2018 and January 2021, when Klopp made specific comment about the matter, Manchester United had had 32 Premier League penalties, which was 8 more than second place Leicester City, 14 more than Manchester City. Across the big five leagues in all competitions, Manchester United at that stage had 48 penalties, compared with second place Juventus, 37. Paris Saint-Germain, a team you would say, you know, the argument is Manchester United gets lots of penalties because they've got quick, talented forwards. Well, Paris Saint-Germain have got quick, talented forwards. They only had 33 penalties across these games. It's an abnormal number, and that's why people were commenting on it. And since those comments have come in, the number of penalties that Manchester United have awarded have declined. And you then have Solskjaer talking about obscure articles on the Chelsea website, which I imagine were read by very few individuals. I'm pretty sure they weren't read by any of the officials who were looking after that game, complaining that Chelsea had mentioned in the 22nd paragraph, or someone employed by Chelsea had mentioned in the 22nd paragraph, that Harry Maguire had got away with violent conduct in a previous Chelsea game and not been red carded. Well, he did. That's the famous incident where he kicked an opponent in the testicles right in front of the fourth official, with the game, I think, at 0-0 at the point early in the first half. And despite VAR being in action, was not sent off. You know, it's understandable that a Chelsea website previewing the game would mention that. To say that is cheeky, as he described it, as an attempt to influence the referees and an attempt to give penalties against Manchester United, is, I haven't heard that something like that come from a manager in a post-match interview in all of my time covering the Premier League. I don't know if you have, Ian, but it's bizarre, and I don't think does Solskjaer or Manchester United as a club any favours. And Manchester United had to brief off record that Luke Shaw had misheard what he claimed Stuart Atwell said to Harry Maguire, to try and dampen down the controversy over those couple of post-match interviews pretty soon after the game.
It is very unusual in terms of a manager and a player who's participated in a match to effectively endorse what is effectively a question of the integrity of the referee. I'm not saying it's rare. I have certainly been involved in interviews and off-the-record briefings where that has been the case, Duncan. But I'd say this, which is both men, i.e. Solskjaer and Shaw, went on the record, on television, in the media, to say that Harry Maguire was told by the referee that if he gave that penalty, it would be the talk of the tune, as it were.
Yeah, exact words from Luke Shaw. If I say it is a pen, then it's going to cause a lot of talk about it after. That's what he said. Atwell had said to Harry Maguire.
Sure, I will say that. Yeah, exactly. So my question is, the FA, who are generally very, very quick to denounce any kind of criticism and certainly questioning of referees' integrity, have decided to take no action. And that seems slightly weird to me, and or bizarre, because it doesn't fit with any consistency that they have shown over, you know, many years and seasons with regards to how they treat the questioning of a referee's judgment.
Yeah, I agree. And I think it looks to me like the Football Association have taken the safe line here, because while it was not a clear-cut penalty, I think the majority of people would say that under the completely messed up handball rules, which have effectively been changed mid-season by PGMOL, who said they were going to take a softened interpretation of the rewritten law in October, it should have been a penalty. Now, as I say, I think the majority of people would say that under those messed up rules, you would give a penalty. I think there's also an argument that it wasn't a penalty in the sense that Hudson-Odoi's arm is out. It's not above his shoulder. But it looks like Mason Greenwood contacts Hudson-Odoi's arm with his arm just before the ball hits Hudson-Odoi. So you have a situation where Hudson-Odoi, if his arm is moving downwards, it's kept in position by Greenwood, causing the handball. Now, under the rules, that probably still counts as a handball regardless, because they're so badly framed and there's been so little consideration of what actually happens in football and what you're actually trying to do. This, you know, as we've said, as we detailed before these rules were even brought into place, this was a response by the English authorities to being found out for applying a handball rule of their own, which didn't fit with the actual FIFA laws for a period of time until that was discovered. And then because they were criticised for that, having the rule rewritten at their behest. And we've seen that that has not in any way improved the game, and probably the most condemned change to football laws I can remember in my career. And I don't think it's going to last beyond this season. But you can have that argument over it. So were the FA to charge Manchester United, Luke Shaw and Solskjaer in this case, then you could see the Manchester United's legal team saying, well, it should have been a penalty under your laws. Therefore, we have justification for our players complaining. And then you also get an argument over what was said by Atwell. And I can imagine a situation in where Atwell says, I didn't think it was a penalty. I look on the TV monitor, I'm still not convinced it's a penalty. And there would be controversy if I gave it. Now, that's not admitting, as is the implication from what Shaw and Solskjaer have made, that's not admitting that he didn't change the decision because he was worried purely about the controversy. He may have felt, well, I got my decision right. It's not a clear-cut penalty. And it will be controversial on top. So he mentions that to Maguire in the process of explaining what's going on. That, again, I don't think that's necessarily a bad move on Atwell's part. But if you turn this into an investigation with Manchester United obviously trying to defend Shaw in case he gets a playing ban and defend Solskjaer in case he gets a touchline ban, then it turns into potentially a horrendous mess for the FA. So better just to step away for it and try and let the controversy die.
Obviously, the solution here is to have you, Duncan, in Stockley Park as the VAR for every game. Because clearly you know the interpretation of the rules better than anyone else. Seems very simple.
Absolutely not. I would hate to be a VAR in Stockley Park. I would hate to be a referee at present because I think referees have been undermined by the video assistant referee system in predictable ways and in unpredictable ways. But it was obvious when you bring this system in that referees were going to stop giving decisions. On the pitch, when they weren't sure about a decision, they would know that VAR was present and use it as an insurance blanket and a safety net, and ask the guys who can see it on screen what they think about it, and use the ability to have another look at it on screen as a way to try and avoid that what they have done for their entire careers, which is make immediate or very quick decisions about what are ultimately subjective decisions. Most of football laws are about subjective decisions. Most of the really controversial ones, red cards, yellow cards, penalties, free kicks, are essentially subjective decisions. So you're changing the nature of the game, and you cannot get clear resolution on this because most of these things are subjective decisions, because the laws have been written into a progressively worse fashion where the people have clearly not thought through the implications of the changes in the laws and not thought about all the situations that can occur and where they will be caught out over them, you end up with far greater controversy and people angry because referees are not making immediate decisions during the game, and because lots of things fall through the loopholes. You allow, for example, incidents to play on because you've been told to allow incidents to play on, and a player can get injured or a goal can be scored in that period where you play on, and then it's something that the VAR decides happened too far back in terms of phases of play, so they don't correct it. Whereas previously, without VAR in place, some of those referees would have said, no, I think that's a foul, I stop there, and we move on with the game. You know, we're not even mentioning here the amount of playing time that has been lost because of VAR, and there's some quite good studies about how the effective ball in play time across the European leagues has declined quite remarkably. Quite markedly, because
under 60 minutes apparently,
because you're wasting, you know, sometimes we've had what, over 5 minutes to get, in inverted commas, the correct decision. Also, we have linesmen being told not to flag when there's an obvious offside, and although there's, you know, it's probably
again,
only
waste time.
Yeah, it's probably only a few seconds each time it adds up in the game. Instead of the flag going up, the opposition getting the ball, we wait.
Well, not just that, Duncan. We could probably talk all day, but we won't, about the ridiculous decision involving Lewis Dunk and his goal against West Bromwich Albion at the weekend, which was then disallowed and then given and then disallowed.
And disallowed, yeah.
And that decision took 5 minutes and 37 seconds okay. Under VAR, and only 4 minutes were added onto the first half.
I think that's right, Ian. I think we've seen that happen in a number of games this season where you have a long period to make a VAR decision. Time is added on, but not sufficient time is added on, which is an area of controversy in itself. What I find not surprising, given the individuals involved and given their kind of entrenched positions of support, and it seems to be that we have now to justify VAR because referees, FIFA in particular, invested so much in the idea that this would improve football and solve problems. But you have, after this weekend, you have Dermot Gallagher paid by PGMOL to be a spokesman on television and explain these decisions, saying that that VAR has moved forward from the clear, only intervening in clear and obvious errors. We asked the referees to go to the screens. That was a big thing, and we didn't say if the referee goes to the screen, he has to change his mind. We still said that he could retain all options. We've seen referees go to the screens and change the decision. We've seen referees stick with the on-field decision too. So it is a better product than when we started in August last season. I do not see VAR being a better product than the flawed product that came in the first place, and in any way a good product. You also have Mark Clattenburg in his newspaper column talking about how VAR had caused problems for referees because of that safety net it provides, and being quite critical of that element of it, and then concluding, I maintain that VAR is good for the game and some of its good may have gone under the radar. Referees were reluctant to give penalties for holding in the box, for example. And he goes on to argue that the referees are now able to warn players that everything's on VAR. Therefore, they shouldn't hold in the box, and therefore there is less holding and less fouls in the box. Look, it's an argument you can make. I'm not convinced it's an entirely accurate one, but if that's the best VAR can do, again, I think the benefits are far outweighed by the deficiencies.
Still a game played by human beings and refereed by human beings, which of course we're all subject to error. And that being the case, VAR is not exactly coming through with its promise to correct those errors. However, in terms of the market, lots being made, as we've already spoken about earlier in the pod, about Erling Haaland and his potential move this summer, we at the transfer window understand that there is another striker on the market for significantly less in terms of transfer fee, but potentially perhaps someone who could be just as effective, and that is Ozan Edouard of Celtic, who has been the top scorer in the SPFL in the last two seasons, and someone who is available for around 25 million euros. It's also our information that Arsenal are a club who have made a solid inquiry with regards to a transfer in this next window in the summer. It's also the case, of course, that Celtic, who are currently under interim charge of John Kennedy, are looking to sell players as well, possibly up to three players to raise funds. They are and have been shown to historically be a selling club, and also that Edouard is obviously one of the main or probably most valuable assets currently at Parkhead. Duncan, I wonder, is Edouard a good fit for Arsenal in terms of the style he plays? What I've been told is that they're willing to market and sell Alexandre Lacazette, who I think is a kind of similar style, but obviously aged 29, and the outlay that Arsenal have put into him in terms of transfer fee and wages is someone they want to cash in on if they can with regards to a move out. So Edouard perhaps is a beneficial transfer that they could make happen given the circumstances and the fee that is being asked by Celtic.
I think Celtic will be doing well if they manage to secure 25 million euros for Edouard in this market. If I understand correctly, his contract expires in 2022. I don't know if they have an option to extend that, but trying to sell a player from the Scottish market, regardless of how efficient he's been, and he has been a regular scorer for Celtic, both in the Scottish Premier League and in European competition, which is something that I think Arsenal will pay a lot of extra attention to. For 25 million euros is going to be a tough ask. You can see the logic in bringing in someone of a similar style and type to Lacazette, who is considerably younger at 23, as a replacement. Lacazette has been close to leaving in previous windows. There has been certainly a good deal of discussion over potential sales without any of them actually transpiring. So yeah, there's a logic there, and it fits to the path that Edu and Mikel Arteta have taken in reshaping the Arsenal squad, which is mainly to get younger players in at relatively cheap prices, who will increase in value and reduce their wage bill, with Lacazette being one of the highest paid players at the club. They've managed to get Mesut Ozil out. So yeah, there's a logic to this potential move.
There must be more interest though, in the sense that Edouard is someone who has proven he can score left foot, right foot, head, free kicks, penalties. He's someone who does fit in terms of being a potential striker who can do well at the top level. Brendan Rodgers obviously coached him at Celtic and knows him well. We know that Manchester United and Manchester City are looking for a striker. Perhaps there will be a market for the player, as well as a market in Europe as well.
I'm sure there'll be a market for the player. And we start in this podcast talking about Manchester City's search for a top-level striker and that there are a limited number of options on it. So any striker at that age who has been scoring consistently, whose transfer fee should be relatively low because of length of contract, is going to have clubs looking at him. But I think from what I gather, he is quite fussy and selective about where he goes. So you have something similar to the Moussa Dembele situation when he was the player at Celtic scoring the goals and had significant interest from across Europe, but turned down moves to lesser clubs such as Brighton and Hove Albion when Brendan Rodgers was keen to move him out because he felt that wasn't right for his career, and waited until he got Olympic Lyon. Did well there and is currently on loan at Atletico Madrid and trying to establish himself in their first team, and you know, has designed a career path for himself, which is obviously an important factor with players like Edouard who are running down contract and who know that the club want to sell them and cash in on them.
Duncan, it's that time of the week when we do heroes and villains in terms of the last few days in football. I'm going to turn it over to you to do a villain because my hero is fairly obvious and it will not take a long time.
I'm going to give you villains, a group of villains this week.
A group? Does that mean a gang? Is that a gang of villains?
Well, you can tell me because they're the Brighton Hove Albion penalty takers.
Definitely a gang then.
who amongst them managed to hit the woodwork twice from penalty kicks in a key match against West Bromwich Albion at the weekend. Pascal Gross missing the first one, Danny Welbeck the second one, and another defeat for Brighton, who, despite all the praise over the fashion in which they've been playing this season under Harry Potter, that they are slipping tight closer and closer to being in a serious relegation fight. Just 3 points ahead of Fulham now. And you wonder if the manager, Harry, needs to get their penalty kick takers to work on broomsticks to solve their the problem converting.
Or a wand at least.
Wave his magic wand.
If not a broomstick. Very, very good. I like it. Although I don't, obviously, because as everyone knows on the pod, I do have a soft spot for Brighton Hove Albion. So therefore, losing games and missing penalties is not joyful in any fashion. My hero of the week, as I said, is a simple one and a sad one as well. And it is the former Scotland international Ian St John, who also played for Motherwell and then Liverpool. Lots of tributes have been paid to the man who was extremely kind, generous and warm to anyone who met him. 21 appearances for Scotland, 9 goals, and a very stellar career in football, as well as then creating a second one in broadcasting with, of course, the St. and Greavesy. I mean, for those of us of a certain age, you know, it was the football show we grew up with. So for me, my hero is the laugh of Ian St. John, whenever Greavesy made a corny joke where he just would give his very, very deep voice. That's it for today's Transfer Window podcast. We hope you have enjoyed what you heard. And if you have, then please give us a 5-star review on iTunes. That expands the community. Subscribe to YouTube and you'll get us on that channel. And of course, you'll be told when the next podcast drops. Also on social media platforms at Transfer Podcast on Twitter and on Facebook and on Instagram. And Duncan and I are on our personal accounts at Duncan Castles and at GarboSJ. We will be back with you later in the week. And until then, stay safe, be well, and thanks for listening.